This podcast is sponsored by Mavericks Western Wear, your one-stop shop for all your rodeo and saddlery needs. Mavericks.net.au.
First of all, it is very clear through all of your music with Midnight Oil that both you and the whole crew are very passionate and have a clear and strong voice. Where does your passion and activism and I guess the strength to stand up for what you believe in come from?
Oh, look, I think lots of others have got it as well, but you probably see a bit more of it because, you know, we're a band that's been playing for a long time and we quite often write about and do those things in our music. But really, one part of it would be, I think, just the character of the people in the band, that we tend to be, we're not passive observers. We like to be active and we are interested in what's going on around us and what's going on in the place that we grew up in. And as our career built, we never really were that chuffed about the idea of having to go somewhere else, whether it was, you know, over to Los Angeles or other parts of the world to be Midnight Oil. We always wanted to be Midnight Oil here in Australia. And I think the second thing is that we made a decision pretty early on, not just to write about things, but to try and learn and understand a bit more about them. And that certainly happened when it came to travelling back in the day, particularly out into some remote areas and visiting a lot of communities, particularly in the NT, travelling with Rumpy Band and, you know, getting to know Yothu Indian, getting to know other Aboriginal musicians particularly, and artists, but also communities and issues. And that grew in us really as a group of people over time. And that probably explains a little bit about why we are the way that we are. Also, you know, we're busybodies. We can't help ourselves. You know, we think that sometimes governments need to lift their game. I certainly know about that. But we'll always be saying something.
How did you guys get together with Warumpi Band for that tour? I mean, seen the doco, and it looked like an amazing time, and some of the music that came out of that. Peter, can you discuss the getting together with Warumpi Band?
Yeah, Dan. So back in the day, there was a lot of discussion and a really difficult political campaign about returning Uluru Tatajuta in the centre of Australia, as Rock, as it was then called, back to traditional owners. And a friend of mine was a land rights lawyer who was helping the community in that struggle and negotiating with governments and the like. And the elders there made a film. They had a film made about the handback of the Rock. And they asked us, would we write some music for it? They didn't really know us that well, but they just, I don't know, I think they were smart. They thought maybe these guys one day, maybe they're going to get on radio one day, so we'll get in quick. Anyway, long story short, we did the music for that film called Uluru and the Anangu Story.
Yep.
And subsequent to that, decided that we'd try and get out and do some playing there if we could. Knew of the Warumpi Band briefly, who just brought their first record out, actually, the first single. And basically hooked up with them and then headed out to places that mainly the Warumpis would have played. Sometimes the bands or people, country artists, would have played out there, but sometimes the places that no one had played, and certainly not with the amount of gear and equipment that we were carrying around. And we travelled all through Western Desert areas around the McDonald's, across the WA border, up the top, Darwin, Nhulunbuy, Noombawa, Port Keith, which is now Wadair, across to the Tiwis as well. I mean, it was really an incredible run. And, I mean, look, we're from Sydney. You know, we grew up in Sydney. We're basically a pub band, and suddenly we find ourselves out on country with people, and it had a big impact on us, and that impact has stayed right through to today.
You certainly have a wealth of experience in pretty much every area. You are an environmentalist, an activist, a former politician. How did you get into politics? It's such a big jump from music and politics.
Yeah, well, so I, about halfway through the oil career, we were doing a lot of work and sometimes benefit concerts with environment organisations and environment groups, and I ended up becoming the president of the Australian Conservation Foundation. It's a big environment group, a bit like Greenpeace, but in Australia. And, of course, that meant starting to go and lobby politicians for change around campaigns, whether it was protecting forests or pollution in the ocean, what have you. And I already knew, but I became even more aware of how important the political system is. It delivers the good and the bad, you know, and you want it to deliver more of the good. And so when I got really involved in campaign issues and in the environment, I was spending a lot of time on it, probably too much time, really. Should have been spending more time with the oils, and eventually it was sort of one or the other for me, and we'd had a really good run, and I just felt drawn to be more involved in public life. And then I got the opportunity to enter mainstream politics. My mum was a big Labor Party supporter back in the day. And when the opportunity came to represent, I thought, yeah, look, I've been singing about it. I've been agitating about it. Now I'll go and have a chance to do something about it. So I did 10 years, or just shy of 10 years in the parliament. I had two terms in government, a cabinet minister under Rudd and then under Julia Gillard. And I really, you know, I mean, it had its ups and downs, there's no question about it, but it was a really important thing for me to do, and felt like the natural conclusion after all those years singing and talking on stage.
bit of a two-parter here. What do you take away from your time there in politics, and did you achieve everything that you set out to, Peter?
Second part of the question first. No, I did not achieve everything I set out to. I achieved quite a lot of what I wanted to do, especially in the first portfolio. We took the Japanese to court on whaling. In Queensland, we did quite a lot of, I thought, really good positive environment work, whether it was around developing marine protected areas, whether it was around trying to do some decent work on the Great Barrier Reef, including First Nations people there. And then in the second part of the portfolio, of course, education was bringing in an education system that made sure that we funded schools according to need. And that was, people might know the word, the Gonski reforms of the day. It was a funny old word from the guy that wrote the report, but that was a really, really big, important thing I never expected to be doing. So, I thought in some ways you're achieving things you didn't expect, but you were falling short of some things that you would have liked to have done. In terms of what I learned, I think the main thing was that politics can be a slow and incremental process. There's obviously compromise involved in every political decision. If you don't have the ability to move forward, even in small steps, you're not going to get there. I was in the parliament when Prime Minister Rudd gave the apology. For me, that was an important step, but what followed has been not satisfactory. But I could see that the parliament does have the capacity to make changes in that area as well. I learned about representing people, Dan. A lot of my mates said to me, oh, you must be bonkers. You're going to be walking around some shopping centre and everyone's going to be coming up to you and humbugging you about what you should do and so on. But I actually liked that part of it. I thought it was...
Really?
I thought it was real democracy. Yeah. Okay. Not always.
Well, you see, you're in a band. People come up for your autograph or photo.
Anyway, yeah.
And now you're in politics. People come up chewing your ear off and telling you what you should be doing.
No, exactly. But I mean, that's democracy. If it's going to work at all, it's got to work in the shopping aisles. It's got to work in the front of the pub or down at the footy game or whatever. It can't just be working on the hill in Canberra. So, I did actually like that part of it, and I had a really interesting electorate here in Sydney because I had, from La Perouse, which is a suburb near the airport where a lot of First Nations people still live, a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, well, not so many Torres Strait Islanders, but certainly Aboriginal people living there. And all the way through, working class suburbs, all the way up to, suburbs which have got sort of views of the ocean and, big million-dollar houses and the like. So it was very diverse. And it was really stimulating and very interesting. I had to turn my music brain off and turn my political brain on, but I have no regrets.
Well, you've turned your music brain back on lately. Your new project, can you tell us a bit about that and shed some light on why it's been such a long time since Midnight Oil have released an album?
I wish I knew the answer to that.
His political brain was...
Got to have one or the other.
Part of it, wasn't it? Yeah. Hey, so I came out of the band around 2002, and I came into the parliament in 2004. Rob and Martin and Jim kept on doing different things in music. They played with other people. They had an instrumental surf band. They produced artists and, wrote songs for people and so on. And when I finished in the parliament, I honestly didn't really know what I would do. I thought that I might actually spend some time back out in remote country working on environment issues and maybe working with communities on things. But as it turned out, we did decide that we would just have a play and see whether it sounded any good. And if it sounded okay, then maybe we'd just go out and have a play and see whether people showed up. Anyway, long story short, a lot of people did come and we did enjoy playing. And so then the question rises up, can you make music again after all that time? Well, the short answer is that we can. People never stopped making music. In fact, I ended up doing a solo record which I didn't expect to do when I was writing my book, and had a lot of fun with that. And that's what we are. We're musicians. So it's you know, it's pretty natural to us. It's like getting back on the bike and to see whether we're all pedaling in the same direction. And when the songs spilled out, and quite a lot of the songs that people had written, well, not a lot, but a number of them dealt with this issue, dealt with, you know, Indigenous Australia, dealt with black-white relations, dealt with stuff that we'd experienced when we first went out with Rumpy Band, which we hadn't forgotten, dealt with the ups and downs of what First Nations people have been through. And so we decided to record those songs first, but to invite collaborations with other First Nations artists, which to us seemed to be really important to give the thing, you know, real sense of meaning and a bit of weight. So which is what we did, really. We had the seven songs, and so we had our wish list of people that we really liked or people that we'd worked with before. People like Kev Carmody or Sammy Butcher we'd worked with before. People that we liked, like Jess Malboy or Troy Cassidaly. And then emerging artists like Tasman Keith or Alice Sky, who we knew about, but we didn't know them personally. And we just basically sent people songs and said, look, do you want to be a part of it? We'd love to have you sing on it, or maybe you want to change it around with your perspective, with a language perspective, because this is what the idea of the song is. And out of that, we ended up with these incredible contributions that came onto the Macarena project. I mean, the fact is that all of our First Nations collaborators have made this into something very, very special. And underpinning it was the Uluru Statement from the Heart, which we thought was a really important document that had been drawn up by a lot of Aboriginal people in a big consultation process. It's got some really important political things sitting in it, but we wanted to present it as music, and hence the Makarrata project, which gets released this week.
Yeah, fantastic work. It's you know, it's great to see you guys back together and getting all those mob together, Bana Laurie, Dan Sol and all the gang. Look, one of the biggest issues, I suppose, or things that we're dealing with as black fellas here in this country, black deaths in custody. Not only that, but, you know, it's fast approaching January 26, Invasion Day for our people. What are your thoughts on both of those topics that are affecting First Nations people, our people of this land?
Well, I think on deaths in custody, it is an absolute national disgrace. And, you know, the Royal Commission, I think it reported in the late 90s or the early 2000s, there's over 300 recommendations. Quite a lot of those recommendations have only been half done. Some of them haven't been done at all. And, of course, as you and your listeners would know, since then, tragically, we've seen loss of life of over 400 people in custody, you know, mainly young Aboriginal people, but not only, and sometimes in really horrific circumstances. So I think this is a big block for us, something that cannot be ignored for another second, needs to be addressed, needs to be a strong movement from white fellas as well to get in behind the campaigns that are already underway and put the pressure on politics and the political system, state systems as well, to respond and to resource the necessary alternative policing, you know, get, particularly if people have got an alcohol or a drug addiction, to deal with that in a rehabilitation sense instead of simply locking people up. For the younger ones, you know, diversionary programs before people get into the system to begin with. Because, of course, once they're in, as we all know, it doesn't matter who, it's really hard. It's sort of cutting back your options for later on. So I think that's a huge and important issue. On the other question around what's got to happen next and how it could happen, and particularly the statement, we need to recognise that First Nations people were first and they're right at the centre of the country. It needs to be in the Constitution. There needs to be a proper process that looks at settlement nationally, whether it takes the form of treaty or a compact, whatever it might be. We need to have truth-telling about what's gone on. I didn't know about it. When I grew up at school, you know, I never learned about what had happened to people who were living just down the road from me, and then, you know, you wake up one morning and they're gone. You know, what happened? A lot of Australians still don't know that stuff. And so I think that, you know, we need national leadership for that. We need, you know, the big systems and prime ministers to take an active control, but we also need a people's movement that operates on the streets and in the communities. And this is too important business. It's unfinished business. We need to get it right.
Do you think it's
apologies,
a lack of education?
Sorry, apologies for the interruption. This is just a 2-minute reminder. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Let's wrap it.
Do you think that there's a lack of education, or do you think it's partially society just being ignorant?
Look, Kari, I think that there's more education and more awareness than there used to be, but we could also add to that, and we need more, particularly in school for people. There's residual racism in the country. There's no question about that. You know, you saw it in the way that people responded to Goodsy and to other high-profile Aboriginal sports people. But at the same time, that's not the majority of the country. I think the majority of the country certainly is wanting to have that change. We want a unified Australia. So more awareness, more talking, you know, kick up the levels of goodwill and get on with it.
I'm mindful of your time. Finally, Peter, a couple of big things coming up. Of course, the US presidential election, and of course here in Murray Country, the Queensland state. If we can get a quick thoughts on both of those.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dan. I should quickly, you talked about Invasion Day as well. So we got a song on Makarrata that deals with that. It's complex. The day as it is wrong. There's no question about it. Whether the date should be changed or whether the day should be changed around to something, there's lots of different views that people have, but it can't go on the way that it is. American election, well, all I can say is down on my knees, fingers crossed, you know, under the Southern Cross, let there be a change. if we end up with someone as difficult and malevolent and Trump running the joint over there for the next 4 years, the world's going to be a scary place. And in Queensland, as a former sitting Labor member, and looking at the mess that the LNP have made of just about everything they've touched, I hope that Palaszczuk gets up, although there's some things that I think need to be done better.
Thank you very much for your time, Peter Garrett, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thanks very much.
See you guys. All the best. Thanks for having us.
Tradition. No. switch. 24/7 in a crisis. White noise, kill black thoughts, I sense. There's a shift, it'll come by the night's end. Yeah, I'm with a light switch. 24/7 in a crisis. White noise, kill black thoughts, I sense. There's a shift, see the ship sink like this.
This podcast is sponsored by Mavericks Western Wear, your one-stop shop for all your rodeo and saddlery needs. Mavericks.net.au.
Cut it.